Thursday, February 7th at 10E in downtown Los Angeles. Corolla Drinks presents the 10E Booze and Book Club, featuring Ghost, My 30 Years as an FBI Undercover Agent, with author Michael R. McGowan. One of the cartel members we had arrested agreed to cooperate. Some of what he told us pointed to corruption at the very highest levels of the Mexican government. When we quickly relayed this very important news to FBI HQ in Washington, we were told to stand down, because what we were pursuing, namely the links between the Sinaloa cartel and the Mexican government, were, in HQ's words, outside the scope of your original objective. February 7th at 10E. Come on out and enjoy a Mangria signature cocktail. Hear me read a chapter from Ghost and meet legendary FBI undercover agent Mike McGowan and his co-author Ralph Pizzullo. This event is free, but space is limited. Just click the registration link at adamcarolla.com. This is Corolla Digital. This is Reasonable Doubt with your hosts, Mark Garagus and Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. The church, but get on, man. Get on. Well, the best hour in the universe. That's Reasonable Doubt. I'm Adam Carolla. It's Mark Garagus over there. Mark is, wow, what a life. And I'll give an analogy. I gave my kids, or actually my son, I don't know how my daughter was last night. But anyway, I said,
She wasn't home.
The weeks go by so fast. The time goes by so fast. And I used to say, when you're busy, you know, that's right. What happens. And I said, you know, when I used to work construction, I like to announce, I preface it by saying, I ever tell you guys stories about when I used to work construction? And everyone goes, ugh. And I go, when I used to get paid by the hour. And it was, you know, I got $11 an hour, $13 an hour, $9 an hour. And it sucked. And I'd stare at the clock, go, you know, give me another hour, another $11, you know. At a certain point, I switched my mindset, which is, I would like to have the shear wall done on this garage by the time we clock out this afternoon. So by 3:30, it was
like
7
that.
To 3:30.
You were thinking, you know, it's the difference between billing by the hour and a flat fee.
Right. I started thinking, I'd like to get the shear wall done on this garage before we punch out, or even by Friday, and it's Wednesday afternoon, mm-hmm. or I'd like to get the rafter set on the ridge, or whatever it was. And I started getting sort of goal-oriented, and then...
What triggered that?
I started thinking, I'm killing myself just sitting here kind of staring at the clock like I was in the ninth grade, you know what I mean? Like, oh, come on, when are we getting out of here? You know, when, come on. Time couldn't pass more slowly. Now, when you set the goal... And the goal's a little more ambitious, like maybe you wouldn't get the whole garage shear walled by 3:30, probably take you until 5. So you're double timing it. And now you're actually looking at time in a completely different way, which is you're actually wanting it to slow down
exactly.
So you can get all of this done.
That's exactly
every
right.
One of your weeks must just feel like one of those weeks where there's 2 weeks worth of work. You're going to try to shoehorn it into 1 week, and you can't get enough done, but it must fly by.
It does fly by. I can't even imagine. I'm going to say the only time during the week, and I don't know what this phenomena is, but Friday at around 6:30 or 7 p.m., I feel like I hit the finish line. And
right.
I don't know why. I mean, that's the rest of the week, it's like I don't have enough time. I mean, you're juggling balls in the air, whatever it is, but hitting in all cylinders, whatever cliche I want to use for the cliche festival. But I was telling you on ACS that, and I just literally flew in from New York, and before that I was in Miami, literally every time I land in Miami for the National Trial Lawyers, I within 3 hours of me landing, I'm awakened, and it's something Chris Brown related. I've never seen anything like it. And it doesn't matter what weekend it is. It's either January or February. Every year in, year out, it is absolutely – I wish I could find a way to bet on this, but I haven't figured it out yet. The
well,
over
gonna,
and under.
I'm going to I was talking on ACS last week, and I was laughing that if I was a publicist, I'd have two marching orders, like for my clients, which would be don't get drunk and tweet after 10 p.m., and never drive on PCH,
because right.
nothing good has ever happened to a celebrity on PCH.
On PCH,
it's
exactly.
It's DUIs, it's head-on collisions, it's vehicular manslaughter, it's monkey
exactly.
nipples or whatever, complaining about the Jews and getting caught on the dash cam of the CHP. Like, it's nothing good ever happened. I said, you'd
that
be better.
That is a good rule of thumb.
Pull never into the like, ocean, you'll have a better time of it. if you're Chris Brown, you can't go into a club, right?
Right. And that's a problem because people don't understand a lot of these guys who are in his position. And this goes for the women as well, who are also immensely popular in that demographic. They get paid an inordinate amount of money. Not just Chris, Drake. I mean, I go through I could tick off a list for showing up. So you do a show.
So it's business.
Yeah, it's total business. So you do a show, you want to go unwind, and you can pick up X amount of dollars afterwards. And then, God forbid, Chris had one in San Jose where somebody pulled out a gun. I think there was another one here, the one where Suge Knight got shot. I mean, there was famously that one in New York with Drake in the exchange of glasses thrown at each other. But those are usually work.
How, you tell me, is it a lost leader? Like, I'll say the same way about like giving Paris Hilton $100,000 to DJ. You know, it's like the club, like I do comedy at clubs. I do comedy at 1,000 or 1,300 or whatever, 1,500 seat theaters. And there's a math.
Right.
And the math is pretty straight ahead. You know, they'll give you like 85% of the door, maybe 80% of the door. They'll charge, you know, $40 a ticket or $45 a ticket. They'll back out the union dues and the theater and the cost of the venue and blah, blah, blah. And at the end of the day, you'll walk out of there.
Who negotiates that for you?
It's a Mike August thing, but it's a pretty standard kind of deal.
Well, because I was thinking back, we've talked about a million times, Perkins Palace. Now, there was 1,800 and whatever it was, 32 seats. And there was two ways to go. I could do just the downstairs, 900 and change, or open up the whole thing.
The balcony, right.
Right. And so I would do the multiplication. And literally on some shows, speaking of loss leader, if I think I know where you're going, I would do, for instance, we did a surprise show with the Pretenders on the night five. They did a run at four shows at Santa Monica Civic. I was willing to do it because it kind of gave us a stamp of housekeeping seal of approval, number one. I said, I'll give you the whole door. Whatever we charge, we'll do it, put it on sale. It's sold out in like 30 minutes. But I'll keep the booze because
right.
that alone is, I mean, can you imagine? I don't know what it was back then, but you could do a ton in the alcohol, food
well,
and beverage.
I mean, that's why the clubs will oftentimes give you 80 or more percent of the door because at a certain point they just become like a restaurant bar and restaurants and bars don't charge admission.
Well, I would
so
also,
they'll give it to the person that can fill the thing. But so the question is, if you're going to give Chris, I'm guessing more than I get at the Brea Improv on a Thursday night, probably.
Right.
You're gonna write a check for $100,000, $200,000, $150, whatever it is. The club only holds so many people. Is it a lost leader? Or does it pencil out?
No, I think it pencils out for them, depending on what it is. I mean,
bottle service
is what does it. You read my mind. They can charge. There's a place Jake went to with Ben in my office. Boring cop.
Boring Ben.
They went. In fact, Tenney got so angry because Tenney gets the American Express
awards,
which is awful because then she knows exactly what Jake's doing, and then I got to hear about Jake's getting this or whatever. So there was an evening, and we settled a case, and we were in New York, and it was probably a year ago, and I gave Ben and Jake the credit card, and I said, here, go celebrate. I'm going to bed. And I was awakened to Tenney, you know, either get a call for Chris Brown or it's Tenney. But it was Tenney because somebody had charged, I don't know what it was, $2,000 or $3,000 for bottle service at some club. And Jake was telling me afterwards when I talked to him about it, he says, Dad, are you kidding me? That's so cheap. I mean, there's guys who are spending $5,000 and $10,000 there.
I should say that the show is brought to you by TommyJohn.com/Adam and TrueCar.com and Fig Leaf Security as well. You can go to Fig Leaf.
Right. Tommy John, by the way, life is too short to be uncomfortable, don't you think?
I agree. I'm wearing mine now.
I'm wearing mine as well. I got my blue. When it comes to underwear, why settle for anything less than Tommy John? By the way, you know why? Another reason I do it? I wear it. It's the most comfortable men and women's underwear on the planet. Keeps you neat, nestled, and for women, panty line free. Comfortable, stay put waistbands, luxuriously soft fabrics designed to move with you. Plus, get this, a life-changing women's line. Loungewear for men. You do the loungewear, don't you?
Yeah, especially
during
the winter.
I'm very much into the T-shirts. Mm-hmm. And women, in the first ever stay-tucked dress shirt for men. By the way, I'm going to get a couple of those. Not only does Tommy John have a no-wedgie guarantee, they also have a best pair you'll ever wear or it's free guarantee. Full refund if you don't like your first pair. What say you, Gary?
I was just going to add that I got my wife one of each of the varieties of the women's line, and she is over the moon about them. But you can hurry to TommyJohn.com/Adam right now for 20% off your first order. That's TommyJohn.com/Adam for 20% off. Only at TommyJohn.com, TommyJohn.com.
I have a question for you, Mark. And as I say, I sit around all the time, and I think about, ooh, I wonder what Mark would have to say about this. And I just kind of do it from a layperson's standpoint. But this big Covington High School thing with the Indian and the Tom-Tom and the poor kid and the standing and the MAGA hat and all that kind of stuff. It strikes me that, you know, free speech is fine and, you know, Kathy Griffin can take to Twitter and say this little fresh-faced punk deserves to be slapped or whatever it is. But when you start trying to find the guy's home address and push it out there, at a certain point, we do get into the fire in the crowded movie house.
Right, exactly.
At a certain point, when you give somebody's home address and you start telling people to mobilize and that little shit deserves to be slapped and worse. And I'm not litigious and I'm also not a, you know, sky's falling Chicken Little. But I am saying when you start finding people's home addresses – oh, addresses of minors, and you start essentially telling people that kid deserves to be punished or punched in his face or whatever it is, at what point are there legal ramifications?
Well, I think that you could literally, if you are targeting the person and exposing the address and then exhorting people to do something, that crosses a line. There's a it's not a clear-cut situation on free speech as to, as you said, to yell a fire in theater, and there's certain other things that you can do and you can't do, and there's a lot of nuances to it. In this case, it's interesting to me only because it hit on so many archetypes initially, and it just kind of rang bells. I mean, first, you see that snippet, the one that kind of went viral.
Right.
And this kid's got he looks like your prototype kid that you'd sent for a central casting that you want to punch in the face. And he's sitting there and you see the snippet and it rings a bell or a dog whistle, so to speak, of people who want to say, oh, rich, entitled, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you get that. It builds up
the narrative. Right. Very strong.
And it plugs in. Mind you, this is all about hitting, you know, various bells and whistles and punching whatever. But one of the reasons why I use this, and I will in picking a jury, I was supposed to pick one in New York last week, but I'm going to pick one next week. I will use examples like this when I voted our jurors because it's a perfect example of you cannot jump to a conclusion until you've heard everything. I mean, it's the whole idea of what a reserving judgment is. Now, obviously, you're not a juror when you're looking at social media, so you don't have to be that way. But understand, before you seize the moral high ground and start scolding, and this goes with equal force left or right, They jumped the gun on the left. They jumped the gun on the right. Why not get the full picture and then do your condemnation and everything else? And why do we have to – I get the finding people. I mean, there's people who famously on Twitter will, when there's a suspect, will put it out there and try to crowdsource leads into finding somebody who's a culprit. That's great. That's a great use of social media. But when it's crowdsourced, where does this person live? Go attack them or go do harm to them. That's vigilante. So that's where it's crossed the line. You can't get into, I mean, vigilante justice is different than a political discourse.
So you tell me how the law works. I imagine if somebody throws a Molotov cocktail through the guy's window and then says, I'm a big Kathy Griffin fan and read her tweet and went and did it, that's much more straightforward than, well, nothing happened, but it could have. You know, so first thing you have to sort of figure out is where is the victim in this? And you could say, well, there's some victimization going on because there's this anguish and the notion of feeling like, you know, the guy from Grubhub knocked on the door and you dove over your sofa and did a shoulder roll and hid under the coffee table.
You've got, you know, legitimate emotional distress.
That's anguish or emotional distress, but physically nothing happens. So if physically nothing happens, it's a tougher row to hoe, I guess.
It is, because you've got a, and just because you say, okay, he looks like a little shit, or okay, you know, he was provoking it, or okay, the other guy was provoking, just because you have that discourse does not make it actionable, meaning you can't bring a lawsuit.
But
you've got to do something more.
When you start saying things like, he deserves to be punched, now we are crossing into a sort of actionable realm.
Right. And then you have to see whether or not, there's all kinds of hurdles on this, because it is core speech at some point. It isn't necessarily political speech, but arguably it could be.
And obviously the deeper pockets are the CNNs and whoever's out there sort of, I don't know, in a weird way, it's sort of like medical malpractice or something. It's like CNN has some sort of fiduciary duty to gather up the facts before they regurgitate them. And the only reason Kathy Griffin would send a tweet that says, you know, find this guy's home address is because she was watching CNN and getting the misinformation in the first place.
But there's so many immunities. Part of what they've done, I remember when we were dealing with, I forget which of them, whether it was Instagram or Snapchat or one of the others, we had to do a deep dive into, Congress has basically immunized, meaning cloak them with immunity for news aggregators. If you're just aggregating, then you get this, you know, we don't want to chill speech. So there's that has been. But so my argument's always been when it's crossed the line is, well, yeah, that would be great if it's a nonprofit, but if it's a for-profit agency, which is looking in this day and age, what's the number one thing? They want clickbait. They want the number of clicks, because click-throughs by, you know, listening to this podcast, the rates get determined by how many people download. The same thing goes for CNN. They're looking, if you don't think that CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News look every single day at the ratings, and especially in the 18 to 54s, you're crazy, because they do. And they've even parsed it down to, they know what commentators rate and who doesn't. So there's kind of that tension as well. When we have gone from just being a news aggregator to who's supposedly reporting on the news to kind of an opinion pieces, then I think there ought to be some nuances in the law that take into account that. Because if you're specifically trying to heat people up, which, and this goes for anyone, whether it's Fox on the right, the MSNBC on the left, if you're trying to heat people up, there is a kind of a premeditation there. There's a deliberation there.
I also heard that I think Congress or congresspersons are exempt from the same from the same rules. Like, you could be sued if you sent out a tweet that said punch this kid in the face, but right. not if you're a congressman. So I guess they decided.
Exactly.
They get to umpire their own softball games.
Exactly.
And for a while, their calls tend to go their direction.
Exactly. And for a while, you know, the government shuts down, but they still get paid. If there's all kinds of passing laws about violence against women, they're exempted. Congress is exempted. So
My God. There are some great stories about the slush fund to pay out the victims and stuff like that that we don't ever really hear about because they don't really need to do anything because it's them. It's not the private sector. That's a little different situation.
Boy, you're not kidding. It's not the private sector. And, you know, it's interesting. I was thinking about all of the little ways that they can carve out so that they don't have – I mean, you know, their health insurance, so to speak. I mean, they get basically soup to nuts health insurance on their own without having to worry. Talk about Medicare for All. That only applies to anybody who's in Congress, basically. You can get concierge service for yours. So it's very difficult. And that's a good point because I was watching as I came in today two comments that got a lot of traction today. One was Wilbur Ross's comment, and the other, I think, was Laura Trump. Both Wilbur Ross was talking about, I don't know why the federal employees are having to go to food banks because they can just go to federally insured institutions and borrow money. Mm-hmm. And people were giving him, and I think rightfully so to some degree, a lot of shit for that. And I just got off an airplane. The last thing I want is an air traffic controller who's working a second Uber to make payments doing the flights. I would imagine you share that same concern.
Yes. You said Laura Trump.
Laura Trump was also said.
I don't know who that is.
I think she's married to Eric. And she was saying something to the effect of.
Gary says, yes, you are correct.
True? Yeah,
yes.
I think her comment was something along the lines
Let them eat cake.
Yeah, that's how it was portrayed. She was trying to lionize the people as, well, their kids and their grandkids will thank them when we get the wall built because they're holding out.
Well, my happy spin on it is if you have folks and they've been working for the federal government for 30 years and week one comes around or week two comes around and the lights are being shut off in their apartment and their car's being repossessed, this is going to be the greatest gift ever because this will be the only time they've ever saved any money. They shall be reimbursed. And when it comes a month from now, they're going to get a lump and it'll be – it's essentially forced savings. And if you think about it, because I'm Mr. Brightside – there's two groups of people that will be affected. One is non-essential federal employees that have money socked away who will not be affected because they have money socked away. And then there's another group who are living paycheck to paycheck and they will be affected. They will be forced to save money.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. I think I've told you this story, and if I haven't, I'll tell you now. I had an uncle named Ocean, literally Ocean. His sister's name was Paris. I mean, we were very innovative as Armenians. I used to see him at family gatherings as I was growing up at 7 or 8 years old, but then he would disappear and I wouldn't see him for 6 months. And this went on for years. And finally, when I got of age and he passed away, my father told me why. He was a CB and he got a pension. CB. And the pension was not enough for him to live on. And he didn't want to work. Per se. So what he would do is every 6 months, he'd walk into the local supermarket, he'd grab a carton of cigarettes, and he'd walk out, get arrested for petty theft. He would plead guilty and ask for the max, and he would get sentenced to county jail for 6 months. He would go sit in county jail, and they knew him because he'd done this repeatedly, and he'd always be put in the kitchen, and he liked working in the kitchen. He'd get rest, and he was a confirmed bachelor. He'd spend 6 months. He'd get 6 months' worth of pension checks would accumulate, and then he'd come out, and he'd live large. He'd play cards. He'd go down to the coffee houses, gamble for 6 months, and that's how he lived. And
Jesus.
So That's the Adam Carolla Ocean, whatever Ocean's last name, I can't even remember now, his Carolla-esque method of enforced savings.
What else is going on?
Well, so we could also talk about, right after I talk about Fig Leaf Security, remember Fig Leaf Security? It's the first privacy story, took place a millennia ago after chomping on forbidden fruit, which they always, it was the apple, and gaining the knowledge of good and evil, Adam and Eve used fig leaves to intentionally conceal their newly discovered nakedness. Today's world, where online activity can bear our most private information. By the way, somebody tried to fish me as I was coming in here. Fig leaf is a powerful symbol for what individual users need to fully enjoy their online lives with peace of mind. Websites and advertisers want to know everything about you. We live in a world where personal data sharing is expected, whether you like it or not. Fig leaf is today's tool for controlling and protecting those parts of ourselves we would prefer to keep private. Fig leaf, an all-in-one solution, it ensures total online privacy, everything you need to stay private in one app. When using Fig leaf, a person defines the levels of anonymity they're comfortable with so you can gain full control of your online presence. See for yourself. Fig leaf, F-I-G-L-E-A-F, app.com. So let me tell you something I've had when I was down in Miami. And I was only on the ground for about 18 hours for a variety of reasons. I at the National Trial Lawyers, I was giving the Criminal Lawyer of the Year Award to my friend Ben Brofman, who Tenney works for. And mind you, going into this last week, I told the story. I don't think I've told you because I haven't seen you since. My father used to tell the story is when he was born, he was Baritza's son. Then his growing up, he was Gloria's brother. And then got married to my mom, he was Betty's husband. And then he, when he, you know, as he was getting older, he was Mark's father. And so I always used to laugh about that. But they were talking about the tempest between Ben Brofman and Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, so 2 weeks ago, approximately, he was let go.
Well, it hasn't happened officially yet.
But there was discussion of
a discussion.
A breach.
So I was referred to as the father of a Brofman associate. That is my new kind of nickname,
right.
Father of Brofman associate. So I told the story of Ben, first time I met him, which was back in 2002-03. When Michael Jackson was being investigated and they executed the search warrant. And then I kept talking to the DA, guy who's now passed on, Sneddon. And then they indicted him, or they're going to indict him. And the count one was a conspiracy count. And it was a conspiracy to obstruct justice, basically, by investigating and putting on ice the family that was involved. Well, I saw that and I knew instantly. I said, I'm going to have to testify. That's aimed at me. Michael Jackson wasn't orchestrating any investigation. I mean, give me a break. And so I talked to Johnny Cochran and I said to Johnny, I need another lawyer. I need a co-counsel. Who do you recommend? I'm not sure that I want somebody from California. And without hesitation, he said, Ben Brofman. And so Ben, that's where I first met Ben. Then, when Ben came out, and I will never forget it, the arraignment, Ben and I come out after we're arraigning Michael. And Michael, who was then, you know, he was in his 40s, I think, does that famous leap onto the top of the SUV. And Ben looks over at me and says, if we don't get this guy under control, pretty soon he's going to come to court in his pajamas, and famously did. So I'm telling that story, I tell another story, and then Ben gets up, and Ben used to be a comedian in the Catskills. I don't know if you know this, but
really, Jewish guy doing comedy in the Catskills.
Catskills.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Because it's interesting to me. I'll circle it around. As a comedian, I you know, they'll go, hey, this other comedian's going to join you up on stage when you do the show in Chicago, or this other guy's going to come out with you, or this person, or whatever. And I know within the first eight or nine syllables that guy says in a mic, whether he's got the goods or not. It's very easy to tell whether that person, if it's going to be a long night, or has that person really got the gift or the goods. It's kind of like when you have the company softball game and everyone's talking, and then you get out to the field and the guy throws the ball once to first base from second base and it skips three times and you go, okay, that guy's not a, he's not a Cracker Jack. As an attorney, can you tell when you meet a guy, he'll give you broad strokes or his, not for nothing. Like, you must be able to tell immediately.
Instantly.
Where this guy's got the goods or not.
Because, on this dais is unbelievable.
But forget about the dais. I just mean, like, hey, here's your co-counsel. You guys meet up. I've been working with this guy. No matter what his reputation is, you must be able to tell within moments whether this guy's going to be an asset and he's got the goods or, oh, boy. Now I have to do all the work.
Exactly. Or, as I've done on occasion, rarely, where I just tell the guy, you got to sit down. I got this. Yeah, I mean, you just got to sit down.
I condescendingly, at a certain point, like to say to those people, I'm going to save you from yourself. And you'll thank me when I'm done.
You know, it's funny because I always say, you know, you're your own worst enemy. Let me just get you out of your own way.
A guy like Ben, when you meet a guy like Ben, you think, okay, this guy's got the goods.
He's got the goods. And then he gets up. And then, but I was worried. I mean, you know, he's right there. It's, he's giving, and it's this Monday. It was just literally on Monday. So he gets up and he goes, you know, there's a certain irony. And he says, I'm not going to do his New York accent, but he goes, there's a certain irony in the fact that I'm getting trial lawyer of the year. And the same day that Front Page or Page Six is reporting that I'm getting replaced by a new dream team or new team. He says, I'm going to tell you right now, right here in this room of 2,500 lawyers, what the real story is. The new dream team had a strict height requirement. Now, mind you, both Tenney and I were sitting on the edge of our seats thinking, oh, no, what's Ben going to say? What's Ben going to say? But it broke up the room. It was a good way to kind of diffuse it.
He's a short guy in stature.
Ben is. I was with him once in Santa Maria during Michael Jackson, and somebody recognized me, came over, Mr. Garagus, how are you? I watch you on CNN or something like that. And then they turned to Ben and said, hey, you're that guy, my cousin Vinny. And
Joe Pesci. So exactly. Together, so Gary will find a funny picture. He'll find in Smoking the Bandit, Pat McCormick.
Right.
And
Burt Reynolds?
No.
No. What's his name?
His partner.
Dom DeLuise?
No. His partner was the famous songwriter. I mean, this guy wrote Evergreen and every big song from like the 70s. Oh, is it John something? The little blonde guy. But Pat was this big, huge stand-up, you know, big comedic actor. And then his partner was... When you hear the name, you go, oh, my God, that guy wrote every half of Barbra Streisand's hits. But
Jerry Reed?
No, there he is. No. That's the guy. I know exactly who you're talking about. Paul Williams.
Yeah, Jerry Reed drove the truck and sung the song. But yeah,
Paul Williams was as prolific as Burt Bacharach.
Yeah. Is that what you and Ben look like?
Exactly.
Get him a cowboy outfit. Go down to Nudie's after the show.
I'm going to send that. Gary, you have to text that to me. I'm saying it to Ben. He'll die.
Tell him if you guys ever pair up to defend a rodeo clown, this is how you're going to walk into the courtroom in Oklahoma.
That's where Ben's going to wheel me in. I have a feeling that's what's going to end up happening. So then you know who the new defense team is?
No.
Well, I think it'll be announced by the time. This is provided that Judge Burke approves of it. We're taping this on Thursday. They're in Friday morning. It's going to be Jose Baez, Ron Sullivan, and Pam Mackey. Jose Baez and Ron Sullivan were the lawyers on Aaron Hernandez, and Jose also was Casey Anthony's. Pam Mackey was Kobe's lawyer from Colorado.
How much? So obviously, when you're dealing with your Kobe dealing or your Weinstein you want somebody in a smart skirt outfit next to you on your side. I mean, optics matter. You want a female somewhere in that mix, right?
I think that it's a safe bet that the last thing you want is to allow a prosecutor to point over at a table and say, these guys don't get it. That's not a good look, and that's going to resonate. Even if it's not going to resonate, you don't want to be sitting there worried that it is going to resonate. And mind you, once you get into trial, it's hard to adequately convey just what kind of bunker mentality you're in. So why even worry about that?
Now, the other fella, Baez.
Yeah, Jose.
Who did Hernandez.
Casey Anthony did Hernandez. Also did a... He won another case recently.
I'll buy you a little time. You were saying who could replace Ben?
Yeah.
I mean, how's this ever going to work? It's going to be a big downgrade professionally in terms of representation if you go any other direction than Ben. Is this a downgrade?
Well, this is what and I would tell Jose this if I talked to him. I may have talked to him. The problem with New York City is, as cosmopolitan as New York likes to pretend to be, as worldly, as a kind of advanced or sophisticated, New York City is, in a lot of ways, its own kind of uniquely place. And when I talk about city, I'm talking about the county courts.
Right.
That is just a strange, unique, I've never seen any system quite like it. And my fear always is, and it's why, with great exception, I won't do a state court case anywhere but California. I always think, why do you want to be at a disadvantage in a courtroom where you don't know all of the nuances and the local culture and everything else? So that is, Jose is a great lawyer. Ron Sullivan, by all accounts, I don't know him. I know of him, is a great lawyer. Pam Mackey, I know, and is a great lawyer. The problem is you're in the New York County courts.
Does this,
and by the way, we talked about this with Cosby. Remember, Cosby the first time around had Brian Monahan, who got him a hung jury, and Brian was the go-to guy in Philadelphia. Second time around, he had that guy from LA, and
so he went in and played an away game instead of a home game.
He played an away game, and he's now away for the rest of his game. So,
is Bill incarcerated at this particular time?
Yes. And probably will not get out. I mean, you know, he's 80 years old. By the time it, you know, gets to...
Bill Cosby will die in prison.
I think he's going to pull a McDougal and die in prison, yeah.
That is, you know, if you are old enough to remember watching the opening of the Cosby Show with him doing his novelty dancing and his big sweater and endorsements from Coke and Kodak
and Jell-O
and, you know, and McDonald's and everything. That if you just took a snapshot in time in 1988 and you went, that guy there, oh, the guy who wrote the book on fathering, yeah, that guy,
yeah,
going to die in prison.
Yeah.
You'd never be able to unpack
How about just go back 10 years and say, OJ's out, Cosby's in.
Oh, my God.
I mean, would you...
I got to write that down. That's crazy.
I mean, that's...
Well, it's actually more than 10 years, right?
Yeah.
But OJ's out and Cosby's in. No, that...
I mean, it's just... And I watched Creed and saw Mrs. Cosby,
Felicia
character.
Rashad.
Felicia Rashad was... There, and you know, it's difficult. Talk about collateral damage. It's hard to watch that movie and not think about him every time you look at it.
Well, not only that, but all those poor people who worked with him and made all the money and had all that success and probably had a good experience with him.
Yeah.
Every time someone puts a mic in front of their face and they go, I don't know, he was nice to me, then they get slammed.
Right.
As
and
well.
Then it's a feeding frenzy on social media.
So they have a choice between taking the guy they met when they were nine and essentially raised him on a set, made him a millionaire and never came at them with a roofie, and throwing the guy under the bus, or saying, hey, seemed like a nice guy to me, and now you've thrown yourself under the bus.
That's exactly
right.
Which
has happened a few times. The Kobe thing, Gary's got a piece of paper, he's got a note. I always got the Fire Festival for you. Well, Chris Brown, we kind of covered, but Fire Festival's
interesting. Speaking of Ben,
didn't we cover Chris a little?
Yeah,
we just talked about him for a moment. I didn't know if you guys wanted to get back to it or not.
But just before we get away from it.
Yes.
You said that she was Kobe's attorney.
Right.
Was Kobe? She was charged, and then the charges were dropped when the victim dropped the charges.
Kobe was a similar kind of procedural posture as Ben with Dominic Strauss-Kahn. They brought the charges. A prosecutor kind of staked their claim, and then the charges kind of disintegrated because of problems with the accuser. And so but Pam is a great lawyer. I mean, Pam is she's
– Yeah.
The problem is Pam's in Colorado and this is New York City. It's the same problem, and I said it well before Cosby was convicted. I said I think I said it on the show if you go back. I said in a state court, I do not want somebody who does not know the culture. You know, I always analogize because it seems to be the only way to get it through to people, and it's even more so. A surgeon, at a certain point, there are certain things that you do when you're a surgeon. There are my friends who are world-famous surgeons will tell you that all surgeons have a certain band of knowledge. They all have a competence level, depending on what the surgery is, and it's kind of perfunctory. I mean, to some degree, it's probably like being a contractor or a carpenter or a master carpenter. You've got a certain amount of competency. There are certain procedures that require a level of skill that you can't really quantify. It's more art than science at a certain point. You've got to know the field. You've got to be able to do it. There, that is the exact same skill set, at least that I can tell, that a lawyer, when you've got the government coming at you with everything in a high-profile case, that's exactly the same thing. At a certain point, it is an art, not a science. And there's no way to convey that. I mean, I will tell you in Weinstein's case, that case, I don't care what anybody says, is going to come down to three things. It's going to come down to jury selection. It's going to come down to two cross-examinations, two crucial cross-examinations. They can have what's called a Molyneux hearing, and they can bring in other accusers like they did with Cosby, but it's not going to matter if the cross-examinations are done in such a way that they don't offend the jurors that you have. Now, people say, well, you know, a cross-examination is a cross-examination. That's not true. A cross-examination where you don't, you know, it's not all, it's not one size fits all. You have to understand who it is you're appealing to. You're not appealing to the judge. In fact, the judge, I've had it a lot of times where I'm doing a cross and the judge jumps in the middle because he sees the prosecution's case disintegrating. The cross-examination is aimed to the jurors and not necessarily all 12. It's aimed to whoever you want to drive your verdict. And you have to know or understand what the sensibilities are and basically understand who it is you're talking to, your audience is.
Can I liken it to this? Kavanaugh hearings, the Republicans had to hire a chick that probably didn't do a lot of modeling from like Colorado to come in and ask the questions because the optics of old white guy with accusatory tone asking woman who's holding back the tears why she can't fly commercially is not going to fly, pardon the pun, with the audience, the judge and jury, the American taxpayers, it won't work. So they hire this gal in, and she hands her a doll and tells her to point to the parts that he touched.
Exactly. And
that's exactly what they're doing, right?
Yeah.
So you can't get up there and take Weinstein's accuser and start bullying her.
No,
because that's not going to work for the jury.
It's not going to work for the jury, and you have to understand who's going to be driving the jury, and you have to understand who's going to be driving the dynamic of the jury, and you have to kind of – your cross-examination has to resonate with them. And then, mind you, at the same time, you've got to deal with a client, and the client is going to want you to kill them. I mean, that's all clients want. Client wants you to kill the person. Killing the person may not necessarily be the right thing to do. It may make the client feel good, but that may be – winning the battle, losing the war of the trial.
Does Weinstein, where was that gal from? Was she from Colorado?
No, was it Arizona. Maricopa
yeah,
County.
Arizona. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which is where Joe Arpaio was from, right?
I love that guy.
Yeah?
Puts all the prisoners in a tent.
How about where
tells
he puts
them to wear old-timey striped stuff. I think he actually wanted him to drag around a chain and a bowling ball, too.
He's an interesting fella. I was in Arizona when he kind of came to prominence, and there was not a lot of outrage amongst the Arizona residents that I was around. But then when you came back to L.A., it was a very, very different view.
Well, you know what's amazing is people don't understand that there are – this happens in California. I went up – I forget the name of the county up north, but somewhere near Napa – and they parade out the prisoners for the arraignment who are in custody. And they're all wearing the same stripes that look like it's out of some kind of old 1920s movie. Yeah, the Hamburglar. Exactly. And it's you say, am I in somewhere in the South? No, I'm in California.
Did Will Weinstein take the stand?
You know, I'm not so sure. That's my father famously said, and I've invoked 1,000 times, it's a rare case that gets better after the prosecution rests, which means if you can try your case within the prosecution case, that's the ideal situation. You never want to have your client on the stand because it's just generally not a fair fight. Mm-hmm. And this may be one case, depending on who the jury is, where they want to hear from him and he has to get up there. Maybe the one exception. Depends on how much prosecution introduces of his statement, because that's another thing. If the prosecution introduces the statement by Weinstein, something that he said to somebody, some interview that he did, some tape recording that they did, some pretext call that they did, if they introduce that and if he did well enough, then he may not have to. I'm not into the weeds enough to know that. But that's also – you have to kind of – also, they don't – that decision is never made until the prosecution rests. You're ready for it, but you don't make the decision until – because a trial is like a organism. You're taking its pulse every – it's like you're in ICU. You're watching what's going
vital
on.
Vital signs.
Yeah.
Do they have to make him human?
Yes.
And sympathetic.
Yeah.
And we don't really know. All we know is a big, brash, sort of Tony Soprano kind of guy who always gets his way and bullies.
Right.
Because it's a big theme now, bullying. He's bullying everybody around him. So putting him in a pastel sweater and maybe having him choke back a few tears up there might go a long way in terms of humanizing him, which I feel like is a pretty important part of this trial.
And it always is, because remember, jurors, what you want to do with jurors is it's a battle of who do you want to help.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's what it is. Jurors pick a side and pick somebody they want to help.
Let's finally get to, and I'll tease at the Fyre Festival, because there's all the docs are out, everyone's talking about it in terms of who do you feel sorry for? Nobody feels sorry for the beautiful kids with all the expendable income. But and then there's Ja Rule, and I don't even know how the Ja Rule part comes in. And
Ja Rule is now trying to claim that he's a victim, if you can believe that. He's been all over social media because he's been getting killed on social media. The competing documentaries are Hulu versus Netflix. Ben is prominent. Ben is like the protagonist hero of the Hulu. Gary, have you seen it?
I have not watched the Hulu one. I've watched the Netflix one, and I'll be watching the Hulu one in short order.
Yeah.
But I think that we may need to dedicate a whole show to this story.
Yeah, because there's a lot of heat around this. It for whatever reason has gained a lot of traction in. Adam, you were front row center. I told it on ACS. You were there as this was unfolding.
Yeah. Well, all I knew, and I had to cut through the single malt haze because Mark went upstairs with purpose and he said, I must take this phone call. I must get this thing out by, 1 o'clock Eastern time or something.
Exactly. And, you remember well. Very good. And you were downstairs and we were up electronically filing at the. You were right there as it was happening.
Trying to get under the deadline.
Right.
And at first I said, well, how am I going to enjoy myself without Mark's company? But then I had another drink and started talking to Paulette about tiling and patterns.
And that was it. You were off to the races.
We're off to the races.
I was talking about cheese sandwiches in the Bahamas or wherever it was, and you were three sheets and three fingers into the Macallan. I think it was a Macallan 18, if I remember
right. Who has the money in this situation?
Well, they just crowdfunded a woman, and I think who had lost 130 grand down there.
Oh, like
so
the,
she got stiffed. Fuck Jerry.
Was she like the restaurateur or
exactly,
something?
She did all the food. Fuck Jerry apparently made a lot of money and now just donated some back. They're a media, social media a person, and we're still pursuing various potential defendants, and the bankruptcy trustee is doing that as well. There's definitely people who made money in connection with this, and it's a matter of determining who knew what and when.
Most of the time, or oftentimes, some of these events have sponsors like Pepsi or Dos Equis or right. You know, whatever, Sky Vodka or something. Do they have sponsorship?
Yeah, there were sponsorships. But that goes back to the question, what did they know when and what were they doing to either
right. The
cover
answer
up or not? Yes,
that's to all that from Mark Garagos is, who gives a shit? They got deep pockets. We're going after them. Not interested in what they did. Come on. Fucking Diageo? Yeah. Let's go get some. I know how you guys roll. All right, let me tell you about don't pretend like you want the truth.
Yeah, I am a truth-seeking machine.
No empty bags for Mark Garagos. True Car. They're not an empty bag. They're True Car.
They're
60 seconds. That's how long this commercial is going to last. What else can you do in a minute? How about get an offer on your car? Just use True Car from your smartphone or your computer. Enter your license plate number and watch the car's details pop up. Answer a few questions and you'll get an accurate True Cash offer from your local True Car certified dealer. You can bring in your car. They'll check it out with you. Take a quick walk around. Ask questions. Get answers. No surprises. Then leave with your check or trade in your car and get a new car or a used car. So when you're ready for a better buying experience and a better way to sell or trade in your car for a new car or a used car, you should check out True Car today. These guys are the best. All right, so you'll keep us posted.
I'll keep you posted.
I'll watch the docs.
Yeah, let's watch the Hula docs this week, and next week maybe bring somebody in. What do you say, Gary?
That sounds good to me.
I think Ben is the hero, two people. Right?
Yeah, I think we may need Ben and maybe one of the directors or something.
Yeah,
we'll
Ben is meme-worthy because I've watched it on my Twitter feed. People keep sending me stuff.
I've seen it too. He's very prominently featured, so he's kind of going around the internet right now.
Right.
Where was the island itself?
The Bahamas, I believe. Yeah. I'm not sure more specifically than that, but.
And what was the island? Was there infrastructure on the island? Was there
a lot of
airports and things like that?
Right?
But
a lot of cheese sandwiches.
And there's so much to unpack. So we'll watch those docs. We'll get somebody in, and we'll sort of unpack it all.
And it was the island called Great Exuma.
Right.
We'll unpack it all for you. Adam Carolla's Unprepared. That'll be February 8th, Connecticut, Fox Woods Resorts and Casino. Then the 9th, Boston, Wilbur Theater. Beautiful, big, beautiful Wilbur Theater. So gorgeous on Saturday night.
How many seats is that?
It's 11. I think it's about 1,100.
1,100?
Yes. And a few tickets available.
Okay.
So we usually sell it out. So come on out and enjoy. Go to AdamCarolla.com for all the stuff you need. And what do you got, Mark?
I got Tenny Mediterranean Tapas, Engine Company 28 downtown. And at the Terminal 8, we've got Prova Pizzeria, which is in Grand Central Terminal and Times Square. And V Palm Springs, one of Gary's two favorite hotels.
The other best
is Casa Tropicana in San Clemente.
Also, say hi to our friend Laura Ingram. She's got a podcast on Podcast One as well. Until next time, Sam Kroll from Mark Garriga saying mahalo.
Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt. Tune in next Saturday for an all-new episode.
This is Corolla Digital.